in London's broadcasting house, Callum Lawrence.
The BBC is 100 years old, and we want to say thanks to some big fans by giving you the role of the century.
Want to be an extra in EastEnders?
Ordering a drink in the Queen Vic.
One glass of drink, please. Mmm, yum. Or pressing the Archer's sound effect button at exactly the right...
Ah, that was too soon. Or doing a spot of gardening on Gardener's World. Where do you want these begonias, Monty?
To see all the opportunities to get your 15 seconds of fame and check all the info, terms and privacy notice, register now. You must be 18 or over and registration closes at midnight on the 4th of November 2022.
Go to bbc.co.uk/15 seconds of fame.
BBC Radio 3, it's just after midday and time for Private Passions, and Michael Barclay's guest is the South African artist William Kentridge.
It's hard to think of an artist with a more striking and ambitious range than my guest today, William Kentridge. His work spans etching, drawing, collage, huge tapestries, as well as film, theatre, dance and opera. Born in Johannesburg and brought up during the apartheid regime, his art is also highly politically charged. His parents, both lawyers, were notable figures in the anti-apartheid movement, his father being Sir Sidney Kentridge, who represented Nelson Mandela. For 40 years now, William Kentridge has used his art to explore the legacy of colonialism and the barbarity of war. He's probably best known for his charcoal sketches that become animations, but he has a keen eye for the absurdity of life too. So we watch typewriters turn into trees, birds flying off the pages of dictionaries, or a film called Portrait of the Artist as a Coffee Pot. This autumn, there's a chance to see his work in a large retrospective at the Royal Academy, films in the London Film Festival, and theatre performances at the Barbican. Well, welcome to Private Passions, William. And we should start, I think, by saying that all through everything you do, in all these different forms, music remains an incredibly important part of your life.
It does, it does. I mean, when I was much younger, I thought I could become a musician. I thought I would become a conductor of opera. And then somebody said, but you understand that to be a conductor of opera, you have to be able to read music. And I said, oh, okay, let's recalibrate. So, in fact, directing opera or working with musicians across different art forms is as close as I've ever got to that. But it has been an essential part of much of the work that I've done over the last 30 years.
You've brought a list which is clearly the result of a lot of listening and, indeed, thought. Mozart, Wagner, Monteverdi, Berlioz. But you wanted to start with the Kronos Quartet collaborating with Trio da Cali, musicians from Mali.
There's something about the combination of the Kronos Quartet and their string quartet and the very different music from that part of Africa that combined together with this traditional Christian hymn, which gets transformed by the singer and by the musician. It is something that is very powerful and, for me, very moving. I listened to it again and again. And when I came to start working on a chamber opera, which we were writing ourselves, Waiting for the Sibyl, this is a piece of music I played to the singers and to the composers, saying we're not going to do the same music, but listen to this combination and the way that the single voice can have this huge emotional charge.
Hawa Diabate sings, God shall wipe all tears away.
Kalumana bo day. Mancera alacaso para cama. Dile de que tu mabe
What a wonderful voice Diabate has.
He's got an astonishing voice and an astonishing sense of the timing of leading you somewhere and holding it and then releasing you. And it's that release, that comfort of that release, which is in a lot of the different pieces of music where you're held and held and held and allowed to fall, but knowing you'll be caught by the harmony that comes immediately afterwards.
God Shall Wipe All Tears Away with the Kronos Quartet and Trio Dakali. A wonderful marriage of Africa and the West. But, of course, that historical relationship is so complex, so bloody, and it's something that really preoccupies you in your work. Tell us a little bit what it was like growing up during the apartheid regime in the 60s.
Well, of course, the first thing is that it was invisible as a child to an extent. That was just how it was. It was naturalised. But gradually, as one grew older, maybe 8, 9, particularly growing up with my family, one understood that things which were natural were, in fact, very unnatural. So it wasn't just natural that all black people were servants living in the back quarters of your house. You understood quite early on, or I understood quite early on, it had to do through particularly evil machinations of the government. And this came through the anger and the rage of my parents as to one new piece of legislation was enacted in South Africa. So in that sense, I was a couple of years ahead of anyone in the class, because without that pointing out, without some system to show you that the way you're living is not a natural one, is not a God-given one, that this is the way it, when you look back, it is astonishing how invisible it was to us growing up through there. But I would say from the age of about 6 or 7, it became clear what was happening. This corresponded with the Sharpeville massacre when I was 6 years old, in which my father was very involved. So knowledge of these events filtered through the dining room table, even if they weren't discussed as specific events.
And this has clearly had an influence on your life.
Well, it certainly shaped my understanding of the world, of the gap between what is commonly presented as reasonable and how the world is structured. It also made a big space for what would now characterize as the absurd. As the absurd, not as the joke or the foolish, but the absurd as a situation in which something has gone awry in the logic, and then this bad logic is followed through to the nth degree. So in South Africa, for example, deciding you will decide who people were by if you could keep a pencil stuck in their hair or by the color of the skin. And then you follow through that warped logic endlessly. And it's only really in the category for me of the absurd that one can actually come to adequately describe it. It's not just tragic, it's not comic, it's more than both of those.
You must feel very proud of your parents.
It's a strange sense at the age of 67 to still have the sense of one's parents on one's shoulders so long. One feels one should be escaped from them, one should be free of that, but it's very much, I don't think anyone ever does. Anyone does get out of those patterns which you've put in place from early childhood, but they're there.
Is there music you could play which actually reminds you of them, perhaps music they like to play?
The next piece that we have, this Monteverdi, Ch'io d'oro, was a piece that I heard very early on. My father used to spend Saturday afternoons and Sunday afternoons on the sofa listening to 33 long-playing records. And one of the records he had was this recording of a Nadia Boulanger ensemble playing some Monteverdi. And that completely intrigued me. It was very different to either a Mozart or to even to the Lieder that he liked listening to, or to pop music, obviously. And it still holds me when I listen to different recordings of Monteverdi. I know that contemporary musicians are very disdainful of the way in which he played it, and they say it's a completely different interpretation or understanding of Monteverdi now. But I've never yet found a new recording that for me has the same emotional weight that the Nadia Boulanger Ensemble has. And maybe it's because of the oldness of the recording. It has something of the unsteadiness of early 78R recordings that were then transferred to it.
There is another aspect to the recording, which is that it was Nadia Boulanger who, not single-handedly, but very nearly, put Monteverdi back on the map. My father, Lennox Barclay, was in her class, her composition class, with Stravinsky's son, Sulima, and he well remembers she made them all sight-read Monteverdi madrigals in the original clefs, and none of them were singers. So he said it was a pretty awful sound, but they fell in love with the music.
For now, you know, it seems inconceivable that Monteverdi was ever overlooked or had to be rediscovered, that he wasn't always on the shelf waiting to be played.
It dates, this recording, from 1937, and it's been called one of the most important recordings of the century because Boulanger was really reintroducing to the world a composer who had been forgotten for centuries. And Paul Duren, the tenors in Chiome d'Oro by Monteverdi, accompanied at the piano by Nadia Boulanger, who directed that seminal 1937 recording. You started out, William Kentridge, studying politics and African studies, and you were on campus on the 16th of June 1976 when the Soweto uprising began and students marched through the centre of the city. You and your future wife Anne were at the head of the march. Tell us about that.
I remember the police on one side of the road and us on the one and talking to the students and then walking down the street until a few hundred metres away or a kilometre away we were stopped by the police and there was a baton charge. But I remember those days. Those days were very traumatic. What were we to do? We were white students on an essentially white campus, knowing that 20 kilometres away schoolchildren were being shot in the dozens by the police. And so it was a question of how does one bring some of those police away from Soweto, where they would be doing less shooting. We didn't expect to be. We had enormous confidence that nothing terrible was going to happen to us like that. We were not going to be mowed down by police gunfire. It was not heroic in that sense, let's take on the police gunfire. But it would have been very difficult to have done nothing at all. I won't say that we did much, but there was certainly a sense of how do we make a way for ourselves to fit into this world in which we live, which was South Africa of the 1970s.
Mm. We're going to hear next Elizabeth Cotton, the American folk and blues musician, a recording from 1965. And the extraordinary thing about her is that she played the guitar upside down.
Well, she was left-handed, and so she was self-taught, and so turned the guitar upside down so that the fingers on the frets and the fingers playing the strings felt natural to her. And she started writing music at a very young age and then stopped. As a young black woman, the only work she could really get was in a department store, and there she met a young child whose mother was, in fact, the sister of Pete Seeger. And she eventually ended up as a domestic servant, black woman working in the house doing the cleaning. And there she picked up one of the guitars that were in the house and started playing it. And she hadn't played for decades and was heard by the Seeger family, who then recorded her and made her music available.
This is a song I wrote about 7 or 8 years ago, I think it was. The name of that, I'm going away. You see, I'm playing this in ragtime style. Thank you.
Elizabeth Cotton with I'm Going Away, a live recording from 1965, when Cotton was already in her 70s. And by the way, all the details of the music choices of my guest today, William Kentridge, are on the Private Passions webpage. And if you search on Sounds, you can hear hundreds of past programmes and subscribe to the podcast. After university in South Africa, William Kentridge, you went to Paris to study theatre under Jacques Lecoq. What made you change your mind from being an actor to actually being an artist at that point?
Well, I'd started doing both being an artist and being an actor. And then I was told by my friends, you have to choose. Do one or the other. You can't do both. You'll be a jack of all trades, master of none, which was good advice at the time, I thought. And I gave up being an artist, thought I would then train to be an actor, went to Paris, discovered after a few weeks I was not an actor, and then tried to make my way into the film world for a couple of years, and then discovered, in spite of myself, I was back making drawings. And then it all fell apart. Then I started making drawings that became animated films, and the animated films combined with theatre, and all this idea of trying to keep a purity of one form disappeared. And at a certain point, I understood the only hope for the work was what came, what fed across from one form into the other.
But these failures added up to something which actually gave you the way forward.
It did. So in retrospect, one can see oneself as being saved by one's failures. But at the time, each one feels like a painful failure. It doesn't feel like, oh, a stepping stone to something else.
I'm interested in how much of your work is collaborative, because we have this idea of artists alone in the studio, especially in Paris, in some garret in the attic. But for many years, you've gathered a group of creative collaborators, including composers, dancers, puppeteers, weavers, and metalsmiths. In 2016, in Johannesburg, you founded the Centre for the Less Good Idea. Tell us a little bit about that and how you came across such an interesting title.
Well, the Centre for the Less Good Idea is it's an art centre in Johannesburg, which we invite musicians, writers, filmmakers, dancers to come together to work and discover the energy that comes from this cross-pollination, from working across different fields. So we have two seasons a year with maybe 20 or 30 different performances in each one. And in the 6 years we've been going, there must have been 600 or 700 artists who've been involved. The title itself comes from a Tswana proverb from Botswana, next door to South Africa, which is roughly translated, if the good doctor can't cure you, find the less good doctor. So it's about when the grand ideas no longer work. You need to find more peripheral things, things in the margin, which can change and shift the big idea in the middle, which is the way that I think almost all artists work. You start with a very clear idea, but in trying to realize it, you realize the gaps and the holes in that first grand idea, and you need insights that have come from the side, the peripheral visions you've had of other images, to come and actually shape and inform it. And so this is a center that privileges and prioritizes and gives importance to what comes from the margin, which is also about being in Johannesburg at the margins of the art or theater world and saying there are still things that can come from that margin that can shift how we understand the world.
Well, we have got a song now, well-known Berlioz piece of music from Les Nuits d'Été, and you experimented with recording it backwards, didn't you?
We were doing a project about the nature of time. We said, okay, in the studio, how can you turn time, which is so invisible, into something palpable? And you can do it in different ways. You can think of a roll of film, which is like congealed time, a roll of film which is 16 minutes of film, and you hold that 1 kilo in your hand, and that's 16 minutes of time turned into a kilo. But also with music or sound, you can play with time going forwards, and then if you run it backwards, it's as if you are running time backwards. So it becomes a metaphoric utopian vision of what happens if things could run backwards. And so I asked a singer, Joanna Dudley, to sing parts of the La Nuit d'Été backwards. And my dearly beloved father, with his usual skeptical tone, asked her when she told him that she was learning to sing the Berlioz song backwards. He said, just remind me, dear, what was it that Berlioz got wrong when he wrote it forwards? Which, of course, is to say, we don't, you know, an infuriating question, the only response to which was to do the performance of singing it backwards and see what that did.
Well, I think possibly for today we might hear it forwards if that's okay with you.
We will listen to it forwards.
Mm-hmm.
Janet Baker with the New Philharmonia Orchestra, conducted by Sir John Barbirolli, in Le Spectre de la Rose from Les Nuits d'été by Berlioz, his setting of poems by Gautier.
I always find there's something about mezzo-sopranos having a rough deal, that one expects a soprano in you. And it's wonderful to have the richness of the deeper voice. That's not quite as strong on the top notes, but so much richer in the mid and lower register that the song needs.
Although a lot of mezzos now are extending their range somewhat, I notice.
I'm sure they get pushed to do that, and it's a pity. The rougher, more gravelly voices.
So do you
so
like
wonderful.
The idea of the old-fashioned contralto?
I do, like Kathleen Ferrier. We could easily have been listening to Kathleen Ferrier with Blow the Wind Southerly. That would have been very easy to have on the list in terms of single voice with all the emotion one can
imagine.
But
that was Le Spectre de la Rose by Berlioz, a song giving a voice to the rose which has been cut and worn by the loved one. In the words of the translation by that fine translator, Richard Stokes, "O you who brought about my death, you shall be powerless to banish me. The rose is spectre which every night will come to dance at your bedside. Now, this dance with death is something which clearly speaks to you, William. You've just shown a film at the London Film Festival in which you danced with a skeleton. Tell us a little bit about that, and for those who missed it.
In the medieval tradition of the dance of death, which was very connected to the plague, the idea that everyone was subject to death, you'd see the figure of death as a skeleton, usually dancing with the Pope, with the king, with the emperor, with the priest, with the farmer, with the guildsman, and with the peasant and the child, saying everybody, death was coming for everyone. And it's two things. One hand, it was a kind of a dance acknowledging death, but there was also another medieval tradition of saying if you kept dancing, you could keep death at bay. If your village all gathered and danced, the plague would bypass your village and land on the next village. And, of course, this is a series of years in which the idea of a large-scale plague has been filling all of our consciousnesses and all of our minds. And how do we avoid it? Will the vaccine make us escape it? Will that be like our dance that evades it? Or is this dance of death following us all around? So it's certainly a question in the air. The piece that I did was, in fact, originally made at the time of the Ebola outbreak in West Africa 7 or 8 years ago, where again had the sense, a sudden sense of what does this premature mortality mean? Everybody knows we're going to die. It's not about mortality as such. It's about the unfinished life or the ungrown death, the death that hasn't earned itself and suddenly appears on your doorstep waiting to be fed.
Mm. One very important facet of your multi-layered identity is your opera directing. You've directed several operas over the last 25 years, Mozart, Berg, Shostakovich. But we're going to hear today the overture to Tannhäuser next. Yet you've not actually directed Wagner, have you?
Yes, and specifically I haven't directed Tannhäuser. When I first was invited to direct an opera by La Monnaie, the opera house in Brussels, they suggested Tannhäuser. And I thought, OK, this is my one chance to direct an opera. And for months I went to bed listening to it, to the Tannhäuser, trying to make sense of it, of the music, but also of the libretto. And after about a year, I phoned them and I said, I'm sorry, I really do not have an idea of what to do with it. So the music was familiar, but I was completely stymied by it. Then when I heard this piano transcription of the overture, I'm not going to be overpowered by the presence of Wagner. I'm going to take him on with this piano and allow, in fact, which is spectacular music in the overture, to come through. But the hugeness of the moments of eruption, of things building and then resolving, somehow feels much more human in the piano transcription.
So we're going to hear Liszt's rather loose paraphrase of Wagner's Tannhäuser overture, so difficult that many people thought nobody could play it, but Michal Rudi certainly plays it very well here.
Thank you.
Wagner's Overture to Tannhäuser in a concert paraphrase for piano by Franz Liszt, played by Michael Rudi.
So there's something in that music which almost feels vulnerable, and one never thinks of Wagner and vulnerability as two words that go together. It's the clarity of the notes you hear, each of them, that I could imagine doing something with this, which I could not imagine doing with the whole opera. I mean, Mikhail Rudi himself fled to the West from the Soviet Union. I think both his parents had been in the Gulag. So there's something in that history which I'm not sure how it translates into the way he plays, but there is something of both obviously the structure and the notes of Wagner, but of a vulnerability in the playing, even in the heroic moments.
Thinking about Rudi's life and the way he fled the Soviet regime, I sometimes wonder whether as a young man you ever wanted to leave South Africa permanently, and what was it that made you so determined to go back?
To stay, to never really leave, to just after the 1 year in Paris. I think it was, firstly, it was clear there was no good solution. There was no good solution. Leaving and being in exile didn't solve the questions. Staying didn't make it better or worse in itself. But there were many people that I worked with, other musicians, other artists, theatre people, that made for a very rich world. And also I felt grounded. This is the world. This is the strange, messed up place, was the place I was living in, and which, for better or worse, I would be dealing with in the work over the next decades. So it's never, it's often not easy living there. It's in a country that's in a state of decline, as is kind of obvious. But there have always been kinds of opennesses and richnesses of work with many people, many actors, many musicians, many dancers, that I think would be very hard to replicate elsewhere.
Like so many countries, it is riddled with corruption.
It is. I mean, it's riddled with corruption. I don't think quite on the scale of other countries like Nigeria and other places, but we're heading that way. And it's an ongoing sadness day by day to think of all the possible things that could have been done that haven't been done, and the amount of goodwill that's been squandered over the last 30 years. And also to acknowledge all the way that many people's lives are transformed for the better, that many, many people who would have had no opportunities before now live in a much more, much richer, much more fulfilled life. So one has to keep a perspective of. I think there's both an optimistic future unfolding and a pessimistic one, and both of those are true. And to claim only one or the other is to miss the point.
Well, I suppose one could say that very much about the next country we're talking about, because it's Shostakovich who is the composer we're thinking of, and his relationship with the Soviet authorities. Still the subject of controversy, actually. You've chosen the 10th Symphony, which he wrote in late 1953, just after the death of Stalin. In fact, this second movement, by some accounts, is said to be a musical portrait of Stalin, isn't it?
I made a film from it called Oh, to Believe in Another World, which is a film projected behind an orchestra playing the symphony live. It became a chance to look at that whole complicated history of the Soviet Union and of particularly Shostakovich or other artists' position in it. What is their position of having to toe a party line but not towing a party line, of being absorbed by the demands of the totalitarian state, finding corners to resist it? And so the idea that, oh, you have to see Shostakovich as this dissident musician feels false, or you have to see Shostakovich as the state musician feels equally false. It's that complicated, paradoxical world in which he had to inhabit when he'd sit with his suitcase at the top of the stairs in the middle of the night waiting to be arrested by the secret police.
I met Shostakovich.
Gosh.
And he did have the sense of a somewhat haunted man. He had these pale, thick glasses, and you almost felt he was hiding behind them. Diffident, a bit sweet, but you felt also somebody who, you use that word vulnerable, and despite the way he managed to lead his life, I still feel that vulnerability is there in the music, as well as, you say, kind of certainty.
We'll be right back.
There's a great line in a poem by Osip Mandelstam, I think a poem about Stalin, which is something about every time someone dies, he sticks out his chest for another medal. And that's kind of there in that music also.
Andris Nelson's conducting the Boston Symphony Orchestra in the second movement of the Symphony No. 10 in E minor by Shostakovich. Determination, darkness, all of those qualities are there. There's a great deal of darkness in your work, or at least in terms of mood and subjects. I mean, literally dark with huge black charcoal drawings. Would that be to overplay it, to describe it as somber sometimes, even tragic?
Someone once asked my daughter, why does your father do such gloomy films? And she just said, well, he uses charcoal, doesn't he? And it is kind of that. If you draw in charcoal and you're continually erasing and redrawing, your paper goes from being white to being a dirty grey. So that does become a kind of tone that is across the sheets of paper. It's very hard for me to know what thematically they all add up to, because one is so lost in the moment of drawing, of erasing, of thinking, how is this movement going? Too fast, too slow? Where should the horizon line be? All questions of meaning in the studio are dissolved into a series of formal decisions. And then the final emotional or tonal sense of it emerges at the end. And it's not something that I inscribe or decide at the beginning. It's not a question of decision, it's a question of what the work becomes. I was once put on an exhibition together with Buster Keaton, and that really pleased me for someone who saw the work as having not only that but also comedy.
Well, Buster Keaton's legacy certainly lives on, and as you get to your late 60s, do you find that you think more and more about memory and legacy?
No, I mean, I try not to. It's a weight, a complication to think what on earth is going to happen to these thousands of sheets of paper and drawings that are in the studio. And so sometimes I have a lot of sympathy with my wife, whose answer is very simple. Her answer is just big bonfire.
Well, one of the things that I hope might be saved in your bonfire of the vanities are your designs for The Magic Flute, an opera you've directed. We're going to end with music which is light, positive, life-affirming, a duet, indeed, in praise of love.
It's a wonderful duet. It's a strange duet because it is a very moving, beautiful love duet between two people who are not in love and who are not lovers. They're singing about the other lovers they would love to be with. Papageno with his Papagena, and Pamina with this Tamina she's never met but has heard of. So it's an idea of love rather than an evocation of direct love. But it's a very beautiful piece. When we did it, I had a drawing of the moon projected behind the lovers. And as the duet progresses, so we zoom into the moon till it's an enormous circle around them. But unfortunately, my drawing of the moon was such that no one could resist but see it as a huge watermelon between the two lovers as we reached it. So one has to try to, well, the pleasure is to listen to the music and not see the watermelon at the same time.
That's a lovely note on which to end. Thank you very much, William Kentridge, for most enjoyable conversation.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure for me.
Thank you.
Evelyn Lear and Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau with a duet in praise of love from the first act of Mozart's The Magic Flute. Carl Böhm was conducting the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra. And that was the final choice of Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions today, the artist William Kentridge. The episode was produced by Elizabeth Burke and it was a Loftus Media production for BBC Radio 3. And you can find details of all today's music if you search for Private Passions on BBC Sounds, where you can also download hundreds of previous editions. And Private Passions returns in a fortnight's time at noon on Sunday, the 6th of November, when Michael's guest will be the Scottish crime writer Stuart McBride. BBC Radio 3 on 90 to 93 FM on digital radio and on BBC Sounds. It's 1 o'clock and time for the news, read by me, Jane Royce. Rishi Sunak has declared he's entering the race to become the next Conservative leader. At least 130 MPs have publicly backed the former Chancellor. Mr Sunak held talks last night with Boris Johnson. Mr Johnson's supporters say he has also met the threshold of 100 backers needed to qualify for the contest, although only just over half have done so publicly. The Commons leader, Penny Mordaunt, who's also officially declared a leadership bid, is currently lagging behind, with 23 declared supporters so far. The Labour leader, Keir Starmer, has repeated his call for a general election. He described events in the Conservative Party as a ridiculous, chaotic circus. 13 National Education Associations have written an open letter to Conservative MPs, urging them to think about school funding when choosing the next Prime Minister. They've warned that the average secondary school will be facing a shortfall of up to £250,000 by the year 2024. The Department of Education says schools will benefit from an increase in core funding this year. The former governor of the Bank of England, Lord King, has warned that the problem of high inflation can only be solved by having slow growth over the next 2 years. He said the economic difficulties many Western countries faced were not just a consequence of the war in Ukraine, but also of successive governments' failure to keep public finances under control. China's President Xi Jinping has become the most powerful leader in the country in decades, after being given a third term as leader of the Communist Party. In staying on, he solidifies his control of China and brushes aside the convention that the party's general secretary should retire after 2 5-year terms. Work is continuing in Ukraine to restore electricity to thousands of homes following Russian missile and drone attacks yesterday that badly damaged energy infrastructure. Kyiv accused Russia of targeting civilians. Hungary's right-wing Prime Minister Viktor Orban has used the 66th anniversary of the failed uprising against the Soviet Union to claim that his country is again under threat. Mr. Orban said it was facing war in the east, an economic crisis to the west, and migration from the south. And the weather, spells of locally heavy and thundery rain will push northwards this afternoon, sunshine and showers in the far south later. And that's BBC News at 1:02.
I'm heading back to England's golden age to discover the remarkable musical culture that flourished during the reign of Elizabeth I and her successor. From the Privy Chamber and church services to lavish court entertainments and the dance floor. Though William Byrd and John Dowland have since stolen the limelight, I'll be focusing on 6 lesser-known composers whose lives were as fascinating as their music, woven as they are with tales of espionage, immoral behaviour, and even a